This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. March 11th is the one-year anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in Japan. What have been the consequences and what lessons have we learned that are applicable to the United States nuclear policy? What would be the result of a Fukushima Daiichi-like event here in the Northwest? To help answer these questions, I have as my guest Arne Gunderson, an international energy advisor with over 30 years' experience working with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, U.S. Congress, and state legislatures, and managing projects at 70 nuclear power plants. Arne earned his bachelor's and master's degrees in nuclear engineering and is currently chief engineer of Fairwind Associates, an energy consulting company. He specializes in nuclear safety and reliability issues. Welcome, Arne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you begin by giving us a brief update on the current conditions at the Fukushima Daiichi site? Is the worst over?
If there's no seismic event, the worst is over. The units are being cooled with temporary piping, and if there was a seismic event and the pipe were to break, they would go back into a meltdown condition in about 4 or 5 days. So they have to be cooled, and the piping is not as strong as it should be. But short of a Richter 7, it probably is okay. The biggest concern is Unit 4, which is the one that didn't have a nuclear reactor core in it at the time. And again, in the event of a seismic event, all bets are off. The nuclear fuel that's stored in that fuel pool could easily put us right back to where we were on the first day.
What has been the impact of the accident so far on Japan in terms of radiation exposure?
There was a massive evacuation over a period of the first month, and more than 100,000 people evacuated from the radiation, plus more than 200,000 not evacuated from the tsunami. So there's been a massive movement of people inland and to other places in the country. There have been no radiation deaths so far, but there certainly will be in the future because the exposures that people received in the first month are very significant. The exposures that people will continue to receive in the future when they come back in are also significant, and I have concerns about that as well.
What has been the impact of the incident in Japan on the U.S., especially the West Coast? To what extent have we gotten exposed from that accident?
Well, about 20% of the radiation landed in Japan, and Japan almost became non-functional as a result. Thankfully for the Japanese, the wind was blowing out to sea and 80% of the radiation went out to sea. Of that 80%, about 77% of it wound up in the Pacific. So the Pacific Ocean itself, it fell in as rain or whatever. And about 3% made it across the Pacific into especially the Cascade Range. We're finding radiation as far south as Southern California and as far north as Vancouver and British Columbia. We're finding it in soil. We're finding it in conifer seeds. And it's pretty much up and down the coast. When the accident occurred, we definitely had about a month where Seattle and Portland got nailed. There were hot particles in the air to the tune of 5 or 10 particles per day that everybody was breathing in. And if you stood outside with a radiation detector, the overall exposure probably wasn't too high. But the particles that were coming down remain a concern to me and to others.
What are the health implications of the radiation that we've received?
You know, it's not a personal health issue. It's a public health issue. And by that, what I mean is, statistically, people are going to get cancer from this, but it's not like you'll know who. Over the next 20 years, we'll see, and the Japanese will see, a statistically meaningful increase in cancer rates. And at that point, you'll know the exact consequences of the accident. So it's not as if a single individual can do anything at this point to reduce their exposure or to reduce their chance of cancers. We've seen in the soil in Vancouver and in the soil in Portland, as many as 100 disintegrations per second of cesium from the reactor, as an example. Now, what that means to an individual is hard to tell, but for a population exposed to those numbers, there are going to be increases of cancer, and we can't run and we can't hide.
And how about our food supply? How badly impacted has it been and will it be because of this radiation that's now covering our coast?
Well, unfortunately, the government's not looking, and it's relying on individuals to look. These are tough tests to do. The United States government's position is that it's below a threshold, and therefore they're just simply not going to look. About 100 or 200 fish, for instance, have been examined for radiation in the last year out of millions that come into the country. We're just not looking. And the device to measure it is not a simple device either. It's not like you can go into the store with a Geiger counter or inspector or one of the machines that are available in the market and hold it over the produce and find anything. The devices to measure that are tens of thousands of dollars and really not something that any individual can use. You know, the West Coast got more radiation than any place in the country, so I think at least for the next year or two until it all washes into the soil, I think the West Coast produce is going to have more radiation than East Coast or Florida produce. But exactly how much is beyond the capability of the machines that I have, and I'd have to go to universities to measure it.
How about the fish from the ocean that we might be eating?
You know, my big concern has been the top of the food chain fish, the salmon and the barracuda or the tuna. And I think when I look at the migratory patterns, within several hundred miles of Japan, there's an awful lot of radioactive contamination. So the fish there are going to become contaminated, and then those will get eaten by bigger fish, which ultimately get eaten by tuna and salmon. In order for it to work its way up the food chain is probably a 2 or 3 year process. You know, I love salmon, so I'm eating it this year, figuring that the salmon are not contaminated. But I'm not sure about next year or the year after, because just like mercury, it's going to work its way up the food chain.
What were the underlying failures of Japan's reactors?
Well, I think there's three. The first is this Mark I design, which was the very first boiling water reactor ever designed. People have known for 40 years that the Mark I design had weaknesses. Then the second one is people have known at least for 20 years that tsunamis much greater than what Fukushima was designed for were in fact likely. And the last piece is a regulatory failure. The Japanese system especially, but also all the systems in the world, have a very close relationship between the person running the plant and the regulator. I just wrote a report for Greenpeace on that very topic. It's called the echo chamber effect, where you get a bunch of experts in a room and they all agree and they all reinforce their agreement. So those three things, a weak design, knowing that a tsunami was likely and not doing anything about it, and a weak relationship of the regulator to the utility, were all causative factors.
How safe are the nuclear plants in the U.S. overall? What are our key vulnerabilities and how similar are they to the situation in Japan?
Well, there's 23 reactors in the United States that are essentially identical to the three reactors that blew up in Japan. And those are the Mark I designs. And I'm on record as saying that these Mark I designs should be shut down. They were tested 3 times and they failed 3 times. And to me, that's unacceptable. You have one in the West in Washington, but most of them are in the East. So out of the 104 nuclear reactors in America, 23 are almost identical to Fukushima, and I believe they should be shut down.
What is the possibility of another major nuclear accident? What kind of risk level are we looking at?
Well, the nuclear industry would say it's 1 in a million per reactor year. And if you do the math with 400 nuclear plants, that means that a major nuclear accident should occur once every 200 or 300 years. But we've had 5 nuclear accidents, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and 3 at Fukushima, in the last 30 years. So, in fact, the statistics show that the chance of a nuclear accident are once in every 6 or 7 years, but the nuclear industry is saying they're once every 200. So there's a big disconnect between what the policymakers are saying and what reality shows it to be.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Arne Gundersen, nuclear expert and chief engineer at Fairwind Associates. Our topic is implications of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster and risks of a similar incident in the U.S. and Northwest. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Focusing in on the Northwest or West Coast in general, how likely is an earthquake tsunami event that could lead to a disaster similar to what happened in Japan?
I think the single biggest risk outside of Mark I reactors, the single biggest risk in the country is down in California at Diablo Canyon. Diablo Canyon, after it was built and possibly while it was being built, discovered significant earthquake faults right offshore. You know, within a kilometer or two of the plant, or within a mile or two of the plant, they found large earthquake faults that could, in fact, really damage the plant. You know, I think what Fukushima taught us is that we are not as smart as Mother Nature. And while we know of these two or three new faults, there's always that question of what else is out there. And just because last time they broke it was a 7, can we be assured it won't be a 7.5 the next time? You know, this earthquake science issue is a developing thing. It's only the last 50 years when we've begun to really understand it. So it's not like you can go back very far in history in the written record and get good data. So my concern on the West Coast is Diablo Canyon, and, you know, that's south of you, but it's certainly the biggest seismic risk in America right now is the Diablo Canyon plant.
Are there other regional facilities in the Northwest that you would be concerned about?
The Columbia plant at Hanford is similar to the Mark I design in Fukushima, and it hasn't been terribly well run. It's had its ups and downs and licensing problems over time. So, you know, within the commercial reactors, I wouldn't say that Columbia is out of the woods. And my recommendation is because it's like Fukushima, it's one of the ones that should be shut down just because of that. The Hanford Reservation has other things going on as well. And I really can't speak to the military issues, but the only plant you've got in the Northwest north of California is the one up on the Hanford Reservation, now called Columbia. I think it had another name early in life. And it's essentially identical to Fukushima. Now, can a tsunami hit a plant that's out on the Hanford Reservation? No. A 20-meter tsunami. But the problem is the plant was designed for a set of assumptions that Mother Nature would throw at us. And if those assumptions are wrong, you can have a meltdown, you can have an explosion similar to Fukushima, because the plant itself still has those fundamental weaknesses.
If that plant had a similar accident, would you expand on what it would mean for Seattle, for example?
Well, you know, unlike Fukushima, that plant is surrounded by land. There are people north, south, east, and west of it. And it really depends on which way the prevailing winds are going. But it definitely, if a Fukushima-sized accident at Columbia affects an enormous piece of the landmass of the United States, including some, you know, prime agricultural land, whether it's beef or whether it's grain and things like that. So at a minimum, if the wind were blowing towards Chicago, you would have contamination in not just the high deserts, but beyond the high deserts into prime growing land. If the wind's blowing towards Seattle, you know, there's a couple hundred miles in between. And I think, you know, the policymakers would be facing the same questions the Japanese were facing back at the beginning of the accident. They were seriously considering evacuating Tokyo until the day after the plant at Fukushima were able to get control of it. By the way, I have to say that the world owes a debt of gratitude to the people who worked at that plant in the first week or two. Tokyo Electric is a bully and is poorly managed, but there were hundreds and perhaps even 1,000 people at the Daiichi plant and the one just a little south, the Danai plant, that almost had a meltdown as well, that risked their lives for us. And I think we really all owe them a debt of gratitude.
What steps do you recommend to make our nuclear reactors in the U.S. safer?
Well, I think we should shut down the 23 boiling water reactors of the similar design. You know, we've known, there's written memos back in the early 70s that say we never should have licensed these plants in the first place. So that would be an important first step. That's only 20% of our total nuclear fleet, and by power level, they're actually the smaller nukes, so it's less than 20% of our nuclear generation. And it just seems to me that the risks of containment blowing up like they did at Fukushima are just not warranted. The second part is we need a tough regulator. And if anybody's been following what's going on in Congress, there's four commissioners who are very pro-nuclear. And there's one commissioner who is neutral. I mean, he's not anti-nuclear. He's a neutral guy. And the four pro-nuclear commissioners and Congress were beaten up on the one commissioner, and this is the chairman, Chairman Yasko, because he really wants to be an honest regulator. So Congress needs to realize that Fukushima can happen here, and the only way to prevent it is a tough regulator. But right now, the industry is so intertwined with Congress that as soon as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission tries to regulate, Congress climbs all over them as being too tough. But we need to break that loop where the nuclear industry is influencing the regulator by pressure from Congress.
Would you speak also about the issue of backup power for the reactors? If the basic electric system goes down because of a tornado or some other event?
Yeah, well, there's two problems here. The first one we designed for is called the loop, loss of offsite power. And that happens quite frequently. You'll have a tornado go through and wipe out the transmission lines. And not only does a nuclear power plant send electricity out to the grid, but when it shuts down, it needs electricity from the grid. So if a tornado were to go by or a violent thunderstorm like you have out in the high deserts or whatever, knock out the power lines, there's diesel generators that are on site that are designed to turn on. And what happened at Fukushima, of course, is that the tsunami knocked out the diesels. And there are other ways the diesels could fail as well. But what the industry is planning to do, and this is a five-year project, so we're not out of the woods for 5 years, is buy more diesels and stage them somewhere so that if there is an event that knocks out the diesels on site, they can hook up a truck and drive them onto the site quickly and install them. The Japanese are taking this one step further. They're actually putting extra diesels right on every site in the country. The nuclear industry doesn't want to do that because they don't want to spend the money. But every nuclear site in Japan will have extra diesels in the event that the diesels that are near the water get destroyed. These diesels would be further away and up the hill, if you will. So the American approach is to pre-stage a diesel or two and fly it in on a helicopter, whereas the Japanese are much more serious about it, and literally every nuclear plant in the country is getting extra diesels before they start back up. But just a difference in design philosophy. The last piece is the loss of the ultimate heat sink, and that happened at Fukushima too. The cooling pumps that cool the diesels were destroyed by the tsunami. So even if the diesels were working, when they turned them on, they would have overheated because there was no cooling water. And the American nuclear industry has yet to address that whole issue, whereas the Japanese understand it and are already doing something about it. So I'm not convinced the American regulators and the American nuclear industry are moving fast enough.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Arne Gunderson, nuclear expert and chief engineer at Fairwind Associates. Our topic is implications of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster and nuclear risks facing the U.S. and in particular the Northwest. Would you expand on the steps that are being taken in the U.S. following the incident in Japan to try to make our reactors safer? What is actually being done? How has it stimulated our safety efforts?
Well, in the next week, right around the anniversary of the nuclear accident, the NRC is going to take the first step. They're going to issue guidance on what must be done relatively quickly, and then the industry will then develop plans to implement those actions. So we're 1 year into maybe a three-year process to get the most immediate problem solved. But they've kicked the can down the road on a couple of these serious problems and have chosen not to address them for a few more years. So we've allowed ourselves to get in a situation where we are delaying safety-related concerns because the industry doesn't want to implement them quickly. It's a matter of money, and they simply don't want to spend what's required in any one year. They'd rather spread it out over 5 years or a decade.
Would you comment also on emergency response plans? If there is an accident, then the plans as to what to do and how to handle populations, especially in heavily populated areas.
The Greenpeace report that I was part of, and that's up on the Fairwinds website, another expert wrote extensively on emergency response. So we've got some sites in the United States that, while they were fine 40 years ago, have now become incredibly crowded. And the one on the West Coast is San Onofre, which is south of L.A. And 40 years ago, when it was built, it was a quiet little country town, and now there's hundreds of thousands of people within the emergency planning zone. We have the same thing on the East Coast with Indian Point, which is only 26 miles outside of New York City. In the event of an accident like Fukushima, you couldn't move those people quick enough. So the question is, how did we get there? We got there because 40 years ago, these were podunk towns that have grown up since then. But the bigger question is, well, what should we do in the future with these plants that are suddenly in high population areas? And here in the East, we're talking about, you know, possibly shutting down Indian Point because you couldn't do adequate emergency planning. I know they're having the same conversation in California about the San Onofre plant. Could we really evacuate a couple hundred thousand people in the event this plant were to have an accident? Emergency planning, I've studied on Three Mile Island, on Chernobyl, and now in Fukushima. And it's always done worse than you think. Have the plans in place, but then bureaucrats and people further up in government delay emergency planning actions. So I'm not convinced, especially in high population areas, that we could adequately evacuate from a nuclear plant.
What do you see as the key lessons from the Fukushima Daiichi incident?
Well, to me, before Fukushima Daiichi, I had traveled over my career from thinking that we should build thousands of nuclear plants to getting to the point where, well, if renewables didn't work and conservation didn't work, then we should rely on nuclear instead of coal. But the accident at Fukushima changed my thinking fundamentally. The lesson that I take home is that this is a technology that can destroy a country. Mikhail Gorbachev said in his memoirs, it wasn't perestroika that killed the Soviet Union, it was Chernobyl. Can you imagine even thinking as a president of a country, I have to evacuate Tokyo? This is a technology that when it works, it's benign, but when it doesn't work, it can destroy a country. And I don't think the risks are offset anywhere near by the corresponding benefits.
If plants are shut down or decommissioned, would you just briefly tell us about the issues that might be involved in decommissioning?
Well, if a plant is shut down and it's operated safely, then the nuclear core is intact and can be put into waste canisters. Then the plant itself gets dismantled for about $1 billion. It takes about $1 billion to dismantle a nuclear plant if it hasn't had an accident. Now, this doesn't apply to Fukushima because, of course, there's contamination everywhere and there's been a nuclear meltdown. So there's two problems then. The first problem is, what do you do with all of the rubble? And for a large part of the nation, we'll probably ship it to a repository in Texas where it will be stored underground for 1,000 years and essentially decay away. The bigger problem is, what do you do with the nuclear fuel? And right now, we don't have a solution for that. The plan had been to put it in Yucca Mountain, which is in Nevada, and that plan has been rejected. So we don't have a long-term plan to store nuclear fuel. The nuclear fuel has to be stored for 250,000 years, and that's kind of mind-boggling when you think that the pyramids are 4,000 years old, and that's about the biggest, most long-lived structure we've ever built. So we need to come up with a solution to what to do with the nuclear waste.
What needs most to be done politically to ensure needed changes in our handling of nuclear reactors and or shutting them down?
Well, I think Congress needs to keep their hands off the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for the operating nukes. There's a lot of really good people at the NRC at the worker bee level. However, their management is subject to congressional pressure. On the new nukes, you know, like there's a couple planned down in South Carolina, it's a different story. The problem there is money. These plants are so expensive, they're not being built by utilities anymore. They're being backed by loan guarantees. So, you know, people in Vermont and people in Washington State are guaranteeing the loan of a power plant in Georgia because Wall Street is afraid that it won't be cost effective. So basically, we're all co-signing a note so that people in Georgia can have nuclear power. If we take the economics and let the market run economics, I think you'll see an entire change in the blend and how electricity is generated.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think Fukushima should be a wake-up call. It should be the bookends to the nuclear era. You know, the nuclear era started in Japan with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and it can end in Japan with Fukushima. We don't need to build new nuclear plants, and we should gradually, over the next 20 years, phase out the ones we have. And I firmly believe we have replacement alternatives. These big generating plants are the way we had to make power in the 20th century. But in the 21st century, with computers, we have alternative smart grids and renewables and conservation and things like that. So the future I see for 2050 is one where we don't have these huge nuclear plants, but instead have distributed our generation around the country.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You have just been listening to Arne Gundersen, nuclear expert and chief engineer at Fairwind Associates. Arne Gundersen will speak at a forum on lessons from Fukushima for the Northwest and U.S., on Saturday, March 17th from 9 to 3 p.m. at University Temple United Methodist Church in Seattle. He will be joined by Nobel Prize winner Dr. Helen Caldicott and Bob Alvarez. On Friday evening, March 16th, at the same location, there will be a showing of the documentary film Surviving Japan. Sponsored by Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, both the film and forum are free and open to the public. For more information, check on the web at WPSR.org. Again, that's WPSR.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at KEXP.org for the next 14 days. In addition, Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to KEXP.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.